Welcome back to the Benny Grab podcast. So what makes nonsense nonsense?
An unconscious mind. It's about listening, considering, and judging, and hopefully improving. I really wasn't a talented kid, a child prodigy. You know, compared to what I've seen very young kids on YouTube doing now, I was nowhere. Yeah, I mean, I decided I wanted to be a professional musician at age six. When I first started playing the drums, the guy would lock me in the building. I was literally in a prison. Oh, yeah. I mean, I would do anything I could think of that might improve my time. I would try it, even if it was ridiculous, torturous exercises.
All right. This is really a short taste of what to expect. This was a remarkable conversation. Inspiring, moving, and even for the most hardcore Gavin fans, I think filled with a couple of surprises. So, as you already figured out, I'm sharing a conversation in this episode with one of my favorite drummers and one of my favorite people, Mr. Gavin Harrison. In this more than an hour-long chat, he opens up about his practice over the years, how he made progress, the methods he explored, and some of the very nerdy and technical tools he experimented with along the way. Have you ever heard of the Russian Dragon, for example? Well, you'll hear in this episode. As I said, some of it might surprise even the most dedicated Gavin fans, but when you listen to his playing, it all makes perfect sense. It's almost like there was no other way for him to become the player he is today. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, here's my conversation with Gavin Harrison.
Hi, Gavin, how are you?
I'm very good, Benny. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. I was very excited about this because I know that you have a very different approach here and there to many things, but I guess also to practicing. So I'm looking forward to pick your brains about that.
Okay.
So my first question would be, when you started out practicing and taking your instrument maybe more seriously, I know you have a very musical background in the family. Did that already like influence how you went about things? Like you maybe saw your dad practice and then it was natural to you? Or would you say you found your own way and that didn't influence you till later?
I think in the beginning, the thing I was most interested in was just playing along to music. So I saw my dad playing along to some records with a pair of brushes. And that fascinated me. I mean, my dad was a trumpet player, but he got a pair of brushes and he played along to some jazz records just on a magazine that had a sort of slightly textured surface.
Right.
And I really enjoyed the way that, you know, he was playing and it was syncing with the music because it was so quiet. He could play along to the radio or play along to the hi-fi.
Right.
So he taught me how to play the basic swing pattern with a pair of brushes and it was just fun. And that led to me just playing along to records and having a lot of fun. And I would do that for as long as I was allowed before it drove my parents absolutely crazy or the neighbors complained.
Right. So was it untainted by any teachers telling you what to do and you were able to do your thing?
Yeah, until I was about 10 or 11, I didn't have a teacher.
Right.
It was just friends of my dad. He would take me to sessions and the drummers would very kindly sort of give me a pair of drumsticks or show me an exercise or show me a paradiddle or a bossa nova or something. And then I would go home and practice it and have a great time. When I got to 10 or 11, my dad realized that now I'd been sort of playing the drums for 4 or 5 years, that it was getting more serious. And he said, okay, now you need proper lessons. And he found me a teacher, a kind of old school guy called Joe Hodson.
Right.
And my parents would take me to Joe's house, drop me off. And most of the time it was on a practice kit. And he was teaching me to play match grip, German style match grip, and to read music. And I absolutely hated it. It's the things he was asking me to do and the way that he was making me strike the drum in a very sort of disciplined way.
Right.
This is nothing to do with music. What am I doing?
Right.
And I found the notation stuff very abstract. Looking at little dots on a piece of paper didn't add up to the kind of rhythms and beats I was playing to along with my father's records. That this was like such a weird concept to me. I was aware that musicians read music because, of course, my dad, every time I saw my dad play, he was doing just that. So it was time to get serious, and I pretty much hated it. I would come home in tears from the lessons sometimes. Oh. Joe was, he was pretty firm with me. Yeah. He was pretty strict, but he was a good guy, and he knew that if I was going to accomplish anything, he had to push me. And it probably took the best part of 2 years before I could really read.
Right.
My ear was already good. Yeah. So he would say, okay, can you play this? And I would go,
This was basically one of these you will thank me later approaches.
Exactly. And my father knew that. My father knew that I was probably going to hate it.
Right.
It was like sort of going to the army or something. And so I would struggle to play something, and then Joe would say, no, it goes like this. And of course, my ears were pretty good, and I could just copy whatever he played.
Right,
and he knew I thought I was fooling him, but of course he knew.
Yeah.
And then one day, sometimes he would come to our house and give me a lesson on my drum set. And I remember him running in to see my mother, because I had my drums set up literally in a shed in the garden. And he went in to see my mother, and he said, "This is the first time Gavin is really reading." Oh. And I just suddenly got it.
Ah.
It suddenly made sense to me. All these lessons and lessons and lessons, staring at these little dots and funny lines on a piece of paper.
But could you describe what that difference was? Like, how did it feel then opposed to before? Like, were you able to kind of listen almost to what's on the page, or like it didn't connect before, or like was it a focus thing maybe? Or
yeah, I don't know, because I think what it was is that a light bulb suddenly went on, and I thought, oh yeah. And of course I was starting to recognize groups of notes and phrases rather than, you know, like when you first learn to read, you're looking at all the letters and you're trying to make one word. And then suddenly you can see all those letters and think, I know that word. I don't have to go to work out what it is. So especially with eighth notes and 16th notes, it all started to make sense. And probably within a couple of months, I was listening to records and thinking, I know that the rhythm, I could write that rhythm.
Right.
And so I would start to get fascinated. I would listen to my dad's records and I would find a bit where the whole band would play a phrase, and I would think, oh, I think I know what that is, and I'm going to write it down.
Yeah.
So it was a fantastic eye-opening awakening for me of the connection between the written note and what I'd always had in my head was all starting to come together.
Yeah, and it's funny that it's almost a parallel to you don't start new again, like, oh, this is the first note, where does this second note land? But you have now, instead of, like you say, the letters, you now have a word or a sentence almost. It's like, okay, that's that. That's a that. I just know how that looks. And this is the whole building block that I will just use. So you have bigger chunks of information that your brain just is like, okay, blah, blah, blah. And the funny thing is that I think that also happens with motion and with, for example, stickings or movements, that we don't think about the single strokes anymore, but like you grouped some things together and your body then can just do it. And but we'll come later. One thing I wanted to ask before that, a little bit back to the you just, or in quotations, just playing to music. How much was that just playing along, or can you describe what happened there? Were you sometimes stopping and thinking like, oh, let me figure out this, or like, oh, what is this? Or was it more a kind of enjoyment kind of, and then maybe a time sense comes in, or holding tempo comes in automatically? Or how much were you like professoring it out already? Like, how much were you kind of, oh, let me check this out? Or, and how much was it, oh, I'm playing along? Like, can you describe that? What was going on in your head back then?
Yeah, I think to begin with, it was just about playing time and staying with the record,
right?
And not going out of time with the record. I mean, and of course, I haven't got any recordings of myself So I'm sure I was, you know, pretty wide of the beat half the time, but I roughly stayed in time with the record. And then there would be some accents or pushes or stops that I would learn and I would know what they are. I mean, I wasn't playing along to Buddy Rich, you know what I mean? Yeah. I was playing along to quite simple, small group jazz. And I was, most of it was, you know, straight ahead swing, because that's where my dad was coming from.
So I immediately thought of like pop music of the 80s, but no, you were playing along to jazz stuff.
Oh yeah. And this is, I'm talking about early 70s. I'm playing along to my dad's kind of Art Farmer, Chet Baker records, small group jazz with very tasteful, minimalistic players. It wasn't showy kind of showboat music. I mean, my drum teacher played me some Buddy Rich and I just thought, wow, that's so difficult. I don't know what's going on there. I couldn't have played along to a Buddy Rich song age 10. I wouldn't have understood what the hell was happening. So I was just, most of it was just keeping time and enjoying the feeling of being in sync and really feeling like I was part of the music. And I'd really enjoy that. Occasionally there'd be the odd push or accent that I could catch or play a little fill here and there. But it was very, very basic.
Nice. Is there a comparison that you might be able to draw towards like other musicians in your age or like friends of yours that maybe did go about things differently? Did you have like a friend that also went into drumming or anyone like kids your age that also did something, or were you a little bit on your own there and had to find your own way?
Yeah, I was pretty much on my own, guided by my dad and guided by my drum teacher. Sometimes my dad would take me to a pub and some friends of his were doing a jazz lunchtime thing in a pub, and I would go and sit in, and it was just fantastic. I would absolutely love it.
Right.
My dad would take me to sessions and I would sit next to the drummer in the big band, you know, my chin was on the floor. That was from about age 8. And I just couldn't believe how exciting it was, how complicated it was, the fact that there was no audience. They were just playing into the microphones.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I thought, oh, this is just fantastic. It was like a fantastic experience.
How much did that inform your vision of like, oh my God, he's doing this. I have no idea. Or was it just more the, oh, this is nice, and then you want to practice? And
yeah,
you took specific things like you saw that and it's like, oh, I'm going to do that?
No, I wasn't that clever or good at that age to decipher some of the things that the drummer was doing. I just picked up on the emotion and the excitement. This particular drummer was called Paul Brody. He was the drummer of the BBC Radio Big Band. He played with a lot of passion,
right?
Even though there was no audience and they would rehearse it twice and then record it, he really went for it. He was thrashing about, and I picked up that a lot. I've never forgotten that excitement and power. He really wasn't just cruising it and taking it easy. And this was a guy who was in the big band for about 18, 20 years maybe. And they played the same charts over and over and over again in a room to no one.
Nice.
You would imagine after 10 years, you'd just be plodding through it. But he never, ever gave less than 100%. And
amazing.
I was so excited to see him play. That's what I was picking up. A little bit later down the line, when I'm 14 maybe, my father took me to a sort of a well-established institution called the National Youth Jazz Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where all the child prodigies to do with that type of music end up going.
Right.
And that was a massive wake-up call. I was about 13, 14, and the drummer at the time was 15. His name was Graham Ward. And I sat behind him, and my chin just hit the floor. It was the first time I could compare myself to someone of my sort of age.
Right.
And he was 1,000 miles in front of me.
Ah.
I mean, he sight read a piece in 11/8. I looked at it and I thought, what does that mean? I've never seen 11/8 before. I didn't know there were such numbers. And I, you know, I was absolutely terrified. I sat behind him and he sight read this piece. And it was like, man, oh my God, you're just like a million miles in front of me. I really wasn't a talented kid, a child prodigy, you know, compared to what I've seen very young kids on YouTube doing now.
Right.
I was nowhere.
Oh.
I was really nowhere for quite a lot of years. I was very average. I thought I was pretty good until I occasionally came across characters like this kid at the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, Graham Ward. And then I thought, oh my God, that's really scary.
So could we even say that that changed the way you were practicing, or that like kicked you up the butt a little bit? And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was one of those moments where I thought, wow, I'm a mile behind here.
Okay.
Oh God, I've really got to get serious about practicing. And I don't think I got serious about practicing until I was about 16.
Yeah.
I left school and I started work professionally, playing little jobs and little tours and little summer season things. And when I got to about 18, and I'd heard a lot of Steve Gadd, I'd heard Dave Weckl, and I'd heard Vinnie Colaiuta at that time. And I thought, wow, I've really got to get serious about practicing. These guys are so far ahead of me. I'm going to have to really pull my socks up and do something about it.
Nice. But what I find beautiful is that it sounds... What I sometimes find frustrating is that it often in like I hear it in clinics or tutorials that people talk about a certain work ethic almost tied towards you got to do this and that, otherwise you will have no chance in the business or like stuff like that. But I find it wonderful that you didn't use any of those words. It was all about, like, in the beginning, it just fascinated you, the power and the passion. And then, like, this guy who played beautifully and then you getting inspired. So it was about the music, or did you already feel like, oh my God, I want to become a professional musician, so I gotta become better? Or can you describe your thoughts around that time?
Yeah, I mean, I decided I wanted to be a professional musician at age 6. When I first started playing the drums, my father was a professional musician.
Oh wow!
And I saw no reason that I couldn't be. So that was it. School was a waste of time to me, and just a horrible distraction from me not playing the drums. So I wasn't really interested in going to school. But of course, I had to go to school. I just wanted to get home as fast as possible and get on the drums and start playing.
Right. Awesome. Hey, how much would you say like your practicing today like differs? What are the biggest differences like when you really take that, okay, you play two songs and you pick out things that you find interesting? How do you practice today? And is there a difference between, because that's what I have in my head a little bit, the preparing kind of practicing of things that come up as a working musician. Oh, I have to prepare this. I have this coming up. I want to write something around that. Or do you then also have your own little practice world where you work on stuff and it's not about like a preparing thing, but it's just you figuring out things? Sorry, I packed a lot into that question, but what I mean is, like, how did your practicing change? How do you practice today? And what do you do?
Some of it actually was down to the circumstances. I mean, when I lived at home with my parents and I had a little the drum set literally in the shed at the end of the garden, it meant I could, once I left school, I could practice all day long.
Right.
Although I could only go as far as the neighbors or my parents could take it. It wasn't really a soundproof shed. And then later when I left home, I was living in an apartment and I had a little practice kit, but I hate playing on practice kits because two very important things to me is the sound of the drums and the touch and the feel, all of which you have to give up when you're on a practice pad.
Right.
And I really like the feel and, you know, developing my touch into a sound on the real drums. So once I left home, I was living in an apartment. I had the little practice kit. I thought, okay, I'm going to really get serious. I didn't have much work at the time. This was late 80s, going into early 90s. So I rented a rehearsal room.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a rehearsal room for local bands. There was nothing happening in the daytime. And the owner said, okay, you can have it from 10 in the morning until 5:30, but you've got to get out by 5:30 because I've got local bands coming in at 6.
Yeah.
And I negotiated a rate 5 days a week, £65, which at the time I didn't have any work. So £65 was a lot of money to me back then. So the guilt trip of lying in bed thinking, well, I'm paying for a rehearsal room, but I'm not practicing was too much. So I really got into the sort of military discipline. I'm getting up at 8. I'm going to have breakfast. I'm going to drive to the rehearsal room. I'm going to set my drums up. I'm going to start playing at 10. I'm going to play till 1. Then I'm going to take an hour off for lunch, and I'm going to play from 2 to 5:30, 5 days a week. And at the weekend, I would be practicing at home. I would be listening to, you know, I used to record myself, and right towards the end, I was actually filming myself, which was very useful. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I got really into the whole, and for about two and a half, 3 years, I went as many days as I could. I mean, if I was working, I wouldn't go, but I would go 4-5 days a week down to this rehearsal room. The guy would lock me in the building because he said, I'm not sitting there for 7-8 hours listening to you practicing the drums. He used to let me in and then lock me into this this basement of an office building. I could get out through the fire escape, which I used to do at lunchtime. But it was fantastic. There was no phone. There was no mobile phone. There was no internet.
No distractions.
I was literally in a prison.
Yeah.
It was the same as solitary confinement. And in many ways, I still crave that because it is completely void. That no one came and knocked on the door. No one rang the bell. No one called me up. No one sent me an email. There was no YouTube.
Is this an environment that you still create when you practice, where you say like, okay, I'm first going to like cut out any distractions and now?
No, I wish I could. I wish I could. And the distractions, you know, of having a studio at home are quite many. And there's many times where I just wish, I mean, if I turn my computer off, that's a good one. If I turn the mobile phone off, that's another great one.
Yeah.
But you don't. So the period that I did in the late 80s, early 90s was really about me getting super serious about practicing. And I think I improved quite a few 100% from going there and coming out of there. And I kept that room going for quite a few years more, even though I started getting longer tours. I would say to the guy, look, I'm not going to be in for the next 4 months, so you can rent the room out. And then I would come back after a tour and start going back to the thing. And it wasn't until I found this house that I'm living in now, which I've lived in for the last 21 years, where I finally achieved a lifelong dream of being able to play the drums at home any time of day and night without disturbing anyone.
Right.
And that changed the way I practiced because there were plenty of times where I'd go down to the basement studio and after 20 minutes, I'd kind of, you know, I'd have played a 20-minute drum solo and bored myself stupid, where normally I would think, oh, let's have a coffee. Oh, let's look on the internet. Let's mess around on YouTube. Let's make some phone calls. But I was trapped in this kind of prison, and that was great. So after 20 minutes, if I dried up, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to think of something else to practice now,
right?
Because I can't get out of this situation. And what's changed over the years is now that I do have a place at home, I do lots of short bursts, probably 5-6 times a day. I'll play for about 15 to 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Something like that until the idea that I'm working on either dries up or I think I've accomplished it or the doorbell rings or the phone call rings or someone's emailed me and I've got to answer it.
Right.
So I do fall foul of the distractions, but I think actually one thing I've learned is I've learned how to practice, as I'm sure you have, because we've done so many thousands of hours of practice. Over the years, the repetition of it all, you start to discover what is really doing you good and what isn't really doing you any particular good at all.
Definitely.
And short bursts, many short bursts suit my suit my personality better than 6 hours, 8 hours locked in a room. Although I did accomplish a lot of things, I don't know if I could do that again. I don't know if I could go back to that.
Right. Going back to you filming yourself, like, what was that really an analyzing tool for you, kind of?
Oh, yeah.
Or
I mean, I started off with a Porter studio, and I would record things. I would try experiments, like, okay, I'll do a bass drum.
Sorry for the younger listeners. This was a tape recording, like little multi-track thing from Tascam, right?
Yeah, four track. I've still got it, actually. It still works. Four track going onto cassette.
Yeah.
And you could only record. Could you record two? No, you could record all four at a time.
Yeah.
You can record two at a time. Anyway, I would try experiments like, okay, I'm just going to record bass drum on its own on track one, snare drum on track two on its own, and then I'll overdub the hi-hat. Mm. And of course, you quickly learn, boy, the timing is all over the place.
That's
a really hard thing to do. I would practice with clicks. The Porter Studio had a pitch wheel, which meant that I could speed the tape up or slow the tape down.
Right.
And I could speed the tape up to full, which is almost double speed, record a click on track four, and then play bass drum, snare drum, and hi-hat along with it, listen back with the tape slowed right down.
Oh, wow. So you really analyze whether you are in line with it or how big the distance is.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
It was
like zooming in into Logic now.
Yeah, it was, of its time, an audio microscope.
Nice.
With no visual representation. It was just my ears deciphering how I felt if I was playing ahead or behind, or it was sounding good relative to the judgment that my ears could make, my 1989 ears, because I've upgraded them many times, but my 1989 ears could decipher how good or bad my timing was. If I listen to those same recordings now with my 2018 ears, it would be so much more obvious to me. But at the time, sometimes I thought, oh, actually, that's pretty good. And then I might listen a couple of years later and think, no, that wasn't pretty good. I really rushed it. I just couldn't hear it.
That is probably the way it has to go, I guess, right? That first, the grid is quite wide and the alarm system is not as sensitive, so to speak.
Yeah.
And like it zooms in more and more and gets more precise and precise.
Yeah, over the years, your ears get better and better at recognizing errors, timing errors, you know, and inconsistencies in sound. But if, you know, if I'd have had Logic back then, or you know, a computer reference, would it have been better? I don't know. Maybe I would have got really paranoid and I would have seen that pretty much if you zoom in hard enough, every note is out of time.
Yeah.
And maybe that would have driven me crazy. I bought a thing called a Russian Dragon in the late 80s, right?
Wait a second. In which subject do we get to? Let's still stick with drumming. I don't want to hear about any kitchen supplies or like.
The Russian Dragon could measure in milliseconds how far away from the beat any other signal was, including a microphone on your snare drum and bass drum.
What is it? Is it a piece of outboard gear? Is it a program?
It was a kind of 1U, half U rack, little piece. I mean, I think I bought it around 1989, and I heard about it, and so I went and bought it. It was really, what it was very good for was measuring how many milliseconds a sequenced keyboard was late.
Ah, wow.
Right? So back in the 80s when we were making sequence keyboard stuff that was hard quantized in MIDI, you could play the click into it and you could see that it was coming out, you know, 15, 20 milliseconds late, which I could feel when I was playing to it. And I would say to the producer, I think the sequence keyboards sound like they're behind the click. And he would say, no, they're all quantized. And I say, yeah, but you know, with the MIDI and the sound card, and I'm hearing a delay, and he wouldn't believe it until I brought this machine. But anyway, I tried to practice with the machine, and that was just crazy.
Wow. Because, Until you became the UK Dragon, basically.
Until I became the UK Dragon. You drive yourself crazy with it.
Absolutely. You can, yeah, definitely.
And I gave it up because I didn't find it that useful, or that I could consistently hit, you know, 1 millisecond behind the beat or 4 milliseconds behind the beat. It was crazy kind of machine.
What do you tell those guys that would say, like those older guys that would say, like, oh, all this technique stuff, that is all bogus, because back in the day we didn't have any of that. We didn't even have a digital click. We had the thing that goes with the dial,
the old metronome
thing.
Yeah.
So, and if that is like placed on a not plain surface, it also does a shuffle and stuff. So, would you say, oh, that's probably right? Like, there is everything that we need in the ears and all that is just helping stuff. Or would you say, like, no, I want to have like logic. I want to be able to have all the help I can get.
Oh yeah. I mean, I would do anything I could think of that might improve my time. I would try it. Right. Even if it was ridiculous, torturous exercises, I would try, you know, especially when I was down at the basement studio for 8 hours, I would think up crazy ideas to see, to test my time, to try and improve it. You know, right. I had a very, very early, maybe early 80s, I had this machine, and I've looked for it on the internet, where you could tap a button and it would give you the tempo. Which nowadays there's millions of them.
Yeah.
But back then this was a weird little analog machine, and I would sit there tapping it and see if I could keep the number the same number.
Mm.
And then I bought a thing called the beat bug. Mm-hmm. And the beat bug was something that you stuck on the snare drum and it would read the tempo that you were playing at. So if you were playing at 120 beats per minute and you're hitting 2 and 4, this machine would say 60. And if you slowed down, it would go 59, 58, 50. Or wow. If you sped up, it would go 61, 62, 63. Of course, if you played a fill on the snare drum, you just have to ignore it. And if you play a syncopated rhythm, if you play boom, ga, boom, boom, ba, that syncopation, okay, you couldn't work out the tempo, but you could see the numbers. So it would go like, you know, 71 and then 45 and then 71 and 45.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, I know the tempo I'm starting at. So if I can keep the numbers at 71 and 45, and I played with that, it was very useful at playing double time and half time.
Wow.
Something, there was a fantastic exercise that Steve Gadd showed in his first video, where you just play 1 and 3 on the bass drum, 2 and 4 on the snare drum.
Yeah.
You play quarter notes, and then you play eighth notes, and then you play 16ths on the hi-hat. And then you go back, and then you play eighth notes and quarter notes. And I thought, well, okay, if maybe the rule should be that I don't need to analyze it with a computerized machine, but if I can play to it, then other people can play to it.
Right.
So I would record myself playing to playing that exercise, and then when I played it back, I would get like a hot rod stick, and I would play 16s along with my recording. Mm-hmm. And I could feel if I sped up or slowed down. So my rule was, if I can play comfortably to this and not feel like it's speeding up and slowing down, that's good enough.
Yeah.
And I did the same thing. I experimented with count-ins, because I found a lot of guys would do a count in like 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Sped up so much in the count in.
Yeah.
Or they would say 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Da, 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 and just come in at a different tempo.
Yeah.
So for a little while, I would practice just counting, do a long count in. I would go 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, play a little fill, and then play 8 bars of groove. Right. Stop the tape machine. I was recording it on a ghetto blaster, a big old ghetto blaster. Rewind the tape. And as soon as I heard the recording of my counting, I would play 16s on the hi-hat with like brushes or hot rods and just feel if the counting was straight. And when I started to come in, that the fill wasn't rushed and the groove was within my parameters, was the same tempo of the count in.
This wasn't a
scientific experiment. This was really, I said, okay, I'm going to be the judge of the timing. And if I can play along to it comfortably, then that's good enough. I didn't even have the opportunity to put it in a computer and analyze it.
It's amazing because it basically like practices empathy in terms of, because everyone that then plays with you will have a much, much easier job. Because it builds trust. You're more reliable that the tempo that you count off will then really like happen. And I think it's key that all those surprise moments that make people a little bit insecure, and that takes away from performance. So you made yourself a drummer that produces less, way less or none of these moments of like, what is going on? And that's why I think then people then always also say like, oh, that felt great today, or like, oh, it feels great to play with you. You had all these weird devices that you were, you now seem to me like, it's the guy called this Russian boxer in these Rocky movies, you know, Rocky had none of any devices. And then there was this Dolph Lundgren, with all those analyzing things. So you are that guy. Probably.
Well, I was very analytical about my practice. And what I've got to say, though, is the more I just practiced, and sometimes there would be months before I got a job, I was very, it made me very insecure, because I had really, my analytical sense of practice was all, critical. I was criticizing myself literally beat by beat. And although it probably did me a lot of good, I didn't feel particularly confident when I went out and played with people, because I was aware of so many errors in my playing that I had identified in these almost laboratory conditions.
Yeah. And you are, of course, then a specialist in criticizing yourself. Like, no one could criticize you better, because you know yourself so well and you've dug so deep that you could be ruthless about yourself, probably.
And I still am. Everything I do,
right.
I can't think of one record I've ever played on that I've listened later and thought, yeah, I could have done that better. I could have made that section feel better. I could have found a better fill. I could have made it feel a bit nicer in that section. I don't think there's ever been a record that came out that I didn't later listen to and think, yeah,
right,
that could have been better.
So Gavin, like when you now have this ability, of course, and almost like a habit, maybe, where you don't think about it, these suggestions maybe or a criticism comes up automatically. What is the point, or was there a point where you said like, okay, this is enough, this is ridiculous? Like, was there a certain point or maybe a phase in your life, or is there again and again when performing a way to get yourself out of it? Or
I think I know myself well enough when I think I've played the best I can play for that moment.
Right.
Be it a recording session or be it a tour, I think, well, under the circumstances, it was the best I could play at the time. I know 6 months from now, I'll listen to it and think, oh, I could have played that better. I don't think I'll ever reach a point in my life, Benny, where I'll just say, that was great. There was no problem with that, because I went through such an extensive self-analytical approach to at least the technique side and the timing side of playing the drums. I don't spend all my time doing that now. And when I play the drums, I'm not necessarily thinking of every single note. Was it in time? Sometimes I can worry about that later on. I might listen to it and play it better later. But that was the period in my life that I really got analytical, and I had to get quite creative with the types of things I was going to fill in my 8 hours of practice with. You know, when you go down a rehearsal room on a Monday, 8 hours of practice on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and after 10 minutes on Monday morning, you're burnt out and bored.
Right.
Well, you know, you're really going to have to think of some things. I took lots and lots and lots of books and exercises. At one point, I had an ADAT machine. I had the video camera. I had the Porter studio. I had the the beat bug, the Russian dragon, and everything else I could think of that would...
And anything, a heart rate monitor and like something. Yeah.
And anything I could think of that would help me improve.
Amazing.
It was really about how can I improve? And, you know, it wasn't in the days of computers, so
yeah,
it was based on my ears as how my much, only judge.
Oh, sorry. How much did you, like... A document like writing down, did you have a schedule like people have when they go to the gym or blah, blah, blah? Because when I tell people about that, I write down all my exercises, when and how long I did them and blah, blah, blah. Like they sometimes look at me like I'm absolutely crazy. Did you do like the equivalent of a journal or a practice plan, like written down or?
Not as literally as writing on a piece of paper, but I would come home in the evening. I mean, I was living on my own at the time when I was doing that practice, and I would listen to the tapes. I would listen to the ADAT. I would watch the video, and I would make notes about, okay, I'm going to do that. Sometimes I would say, right, it's 11 o'clock. The next 30 minutes, I'm just going to practice double bass drum. Mm. And I'm not going to do anything else except double bass drum for half an hour. Then I might think, I'll do some odd times. I bought this, another little device was the Boss TR, no, it wasn't TR, it was the Bassline 303, TO-303, mm-hmm. right? The thing that became the sort of god of house music in the 90s.
Right.
And I found this thing in a local music shop secondhand, and you could program bass lines into it. Mm. Very crudely. It had a one octave keyboard, and you could push a button to go up an octave or down an octave. But the thing I liked the most was that I could program little bass patterns in odd times, anything up to 15. Mm-hmm. So I would program a little thing in 7, and then you can get the tempo where you want it. There's no click, and it would just play a bass line. Boom, bing, bubba-da-bing, boom, bing, bubba-da-bing, forever. So being... You know, getting comfortable with odd times, I could practice in over that one riff for 20 minutes, half an hour. Then I would change it to some other stored patterns that I'd put in, a bass line in 5, a bass line in 9, bass line in 11, 13, 15, all these things. And sometimes it was fun to have bass lines that had big holes in them.
Yeah.
So it would go boom, ba-da, ba-dum. So you had to fill in and make it feel good.
Yeah.
With those massive, there was no click.
Right.
But of course the bass line was quantized itself. And so I had a lot of fun actually playing along with that and getting more comfortable with playing fills and going over the bar line and playing polyrhythms over bass lines that were in 5, 7, 9, 11, 13, 15, and try to get more comfortable with odd times.
Right. There are two things that jump out to me here. First, of course you did a lot of documenting, like audio wise, recording yourself, even like using slowing down, zooming in kind of tricks. But of course you also had a time where you then listen to it, which is an important part, right? Like, because sometimes people record themselves and then they're like, yeah, I like the energy of recording that, but I think you also had a very dissective and then, okay, let me see what I actually got. So you brought together the how it feels while playing with the how it actually really is.
Yeah.
And really tried to bridge that gap, probably, where
that
you
was,
know.
That was my teacher. And right. I used to record every single gig I did. I recorded it on my little Walkman.
Nice.
Down but on the floor. I mean, it sound terrible. And I just wanted to listen to the timing.
Yeah.
And I would listen to it the next day. It would sound dreadful as an old piece of audio recording. And sometimes I would play along with a pair of brushes or on a practice pad, play along 16s and think, oh yeah, that felt pretty good. When I went into halftime, it sounded like I slowed down. When we started playing really quiet, it felt like I slowed down.
Yeah.
So there's something to be aware of. Next time I play that song, I must be more aware that when I play quiet, there's a tendency to slow down.
Right.
And when I play much louder, there will be a tendency to speed up.
Yeah.
And when there's a fill, there's a tendency to speed up.
Yeah.
And after a crash, the next snare is normally late, you know, and start to recognize some of the pitfalls, and that when I'm playing, I'm thinking about, oh, hang on, there's a pitfall coming here. Mm-hmm. Let me really try to hang on to the time as strong as possible here.
So you get to know yourself much better, basically, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
And yeah. Cool. The second thing that really sticks out to me is, like, we talked a lot about practicing, but I think 95% of the exercises and the stuff we were talking about, or you were speaking about, were all like a little bit of sound, but mainly time stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Time and groove stuff. So could you say, like, that is the biggest, or that was the biggest percentage of your practicing, probably? That was your main focus, it sounds like.
Yeah, to a large degree, and probably still is now.
Nice.
I mean, my father's generation, my dad was always about, oh, I don't care what the drummer plays. It's all about the time and how it feels. And my dad was playing in a nightclub in London called The Talk of the Town. And every month they would have a new artist do a month cabaret. And sometimes it was Stevie Wonder. Sometimes it was Diana Ross. Sometimes it was Mel Torme. Sometimes it was, you know, all sorts of artists. And quite often the artists would bring their own drummer and maybe their own piano player. Sometimes they'd bring their entire rhythm section, but quite often there was a drummer who would come to play with, let's say, Madeline Bell or, I don't know, Cilla Black or Tom Jones or any hundreds of different artists. And my dad would come home and say, oh, there's this great guy called Charlie Persip. He was playing, he's doing, I don't know who the artist was, maybe, I mean, like Pearl Bailey. Pearl Bailey's husband was Louis Belson. And Louis Belson would come down and do the month cabaret. And my dad would take me to see the show. He took me to the rehearsals. I met Louis Belson. I sat on his kit. I had a photograph with him. And my dad would come home and talk about it and say, you know, as a trumpet player, the drummer, if his time is, you know, a certain way, the whole band lights up. Mm-hmm. And other times my dad would come home and say, oh, the drummer we've got this month is terrible. He's driving us all crazy. He keeps speeding up. Right. Oh, God, it's a nightmare. And
it's amazing because you always got, sometimes maybe without asking, you got the perspective of how it is for the musicians to play with the drummer. And you always got that perspective that informed you probably very much.
Yeah, my dad was a big influence like that. We would have lots of discussions. It was all about time. He didn't care about, I can play double bass drum or you can play a fancy fill or anything like that. It was all about the time and the swing, in his case, and how it made the music feel from the trumpet player's point of view. And, you know, he really liked Mel Lewis. He thought Mel Lewis was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
He made the band swing. He made it feel good. And, you know, he liked Tony Williams and he liked the energy. It wasn't really so much about can they play perfect time. It was really about the drummers, how they made the band feel.
Yeah.
The band was a resident big band in the nightclub, and they pretty much all agreed that certain drummers would come in and they'd say, oh, yeah, this is absolutely cooking. I remember my dad saying, I'm really looking forward to doing this month cabaret with whoever, because this singer's drummer is just great, and we're really enjoy. And then other months, you'd say it's a nightmare. I'm hating it. The drummer's rushing, or he's dragging, and it's so. It was very much my dad's instruction to me was just try to get your timing as good. It's all about time and feel.
Yeah.
The other stuff, you know, don't worry about it, because everyone else in the band couldn't care less if you can play a triplet flam paradiddle or, you know, on five agogo bells. The other guys in the band don't care about that. All they care about. And I found that out when I started playing bass. I got into playing bass in my early 20s, and I would play along with records and I would play along with other drummers. Friends of mine would come to my house and I'd say, get on the drums. And they'd get on the drums and I'd play bass with them.
Mm.
And I think, wow, they've got a horrible feel. Or, God, this guy's bass drum, he's putting it right in the pocket.
Yeah.
You know, I would start to notice things about their time because I had a bass in my hand. And I thought I started to understand what a bass player would want from a drummer.
Actually, that is my favorite Tascam moment where I got this Tasker multi-track thingy and I wanted to record, like, just see, like, to do this multi-track thing. So I had a bass and I was like, that everyone can play the bass, right? It's like E string. It's going to be great. And then I was like, yeah, I'm just going to play something quick to play on top of it on the drums. So I went on the drums and I played something where I was like, oh, this is simple, right? I played something and then I tried to play bass to it and I became so mad at this stupid drummer.
Yeah.
Because it was just like the bass drum was always a little bit different and I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? This is how people feel when they play with me. It's, oh my God. So, but that fascinates me because it seems like you are through your dad and through that kind of feedback constantly. You are basically a drummer with the value system of a non-drummer, so to speak. Like, yeah. Really programmed with like, ah, that's how it is for the other people.
Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you something else. Do you still have a couple more minutes?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Because we work sometimes with the same people, I know something and I want to ask you about it because I think it will be valuable for this podcast. I know that you did a tour about recording in Italy.
Yeah.
And I know that you worked with many, many different people that came there and you basically, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you basically put them into your chair and said like, hey, do this, play to this track, play this beat, only this beat. And you had the opportunity to nowadays listen to a couple of people, basically trying to follow your exercises or your tasks, so to speak. What did you learn from that? How was that experience for you? What, with your eyes, with your ears now, what did you listen to? Like, what?
Well, it was a very interesting experiment, and it was interesting also that I did it in a few different countries, and the experiment was basically a recording masterclass where 12 students came in the room, and at some point I would send them into the control room. I would play this easy 2-minute song, sounded a bit like The Gaucho by Steely Dan. Slow groove, couple of accents, but basically slow groove, 16th note on the hi-hat. Mm-hmm. And then I would ask one by one, they would come into the live room. They would put on my headphones. I would stand next to them. I'd explain the counting and they would record on my drum kit at the same level. We didn't change any of the levels on the desk,
right.
And they would record the 2-minute piece. And then they would go back in the control room, next person come out. And at the end, once we'd got all 12 drummers recorded and myself, we'd go in the control room and listen back. And I'd say, right, who was the first drummer? Right, you, come stand next to me. Let's analyze this as if I'm a producer. I'll give you my experience that I've had in studios of producers listening very carefully. And 99% of them had the same issues. And I recognized them because I had the same issues.
Right.
Inconsistent hits, inconsistent volume, bass drum really not in sync with the hands, rushing the fills.
Right.
Quite often finding a nice little groove going along for 4, 5, 6 measures, and then they would decide to change the bass drum pattern and do something a little more fancy on the bass drum, and then the time would go.
Right.
And I felt it was valuable for them and the other 11 drummers who were also listening, standing behind them, to have pointed out by someone who maybe has more experienced ears than them some of the errors. And I kept saying to them, look, this isn't an audition. And I'm going to erase everything. No one will ever hear this, right? This isn't an audition. This is just me giving you an experience close to the kind of experiences that I've first had when I went into studios and producers would say, hang on, that snare drum was early.
Right.
That bass drum was late. You rushed that fill. And I'd be thinking, what? What? Mm. What are you talking about? Sounded okay to me.
Yeah.
And so I would point out certain things. I mean, I wouldn't destroy them, but I would point out certain things. And pretty much all of the drummers, there were certain habits that were forming. And then I would take them in back into the studio, and I would show them some exercises that I had felt were helpful to me to try to overcome some of the issues that they had just, you know, demonstrated.
Would you share them with us?
Well, yeah. And some of this stuff I recently did on that Dremio thing, and it was basically about playing 16th notes on the hi-hat and playing just regular pop bass drum lines. Let's take a bass drum line like Lovely Day, bump, 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 ba, bump, and play 16s on the hi-hat, but start with your left hand.
Mm-hmm.
Tightly close the hi-hat and play 16s, accent the quarter note, tut, 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 but now it's starting with your weak hand, and then play bump, 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 ba, bump. And try not to make a flam between the bass drum and hi-hat. Sometimes I told people, okay, first play 20 flams between the hi-hat and bass drum. Get used to what that sounds like.
Yeah.
Now try to play 20 notes that aren't flams and get used to what that sounds like.
Ah. And so then, you basically calibrate. You say like, this is the...
Exactly.
This is the right. Now we want to... Yeah.
Yeah. And unbelievably, it's actually quite hard.
Yeah.
When you play a figure like that bass drum line, and I had 10 different bass drum lines from just 4/4 pop songs. And when you come at it starting with the left hand, it suddenly seems very difficult.
Yeah.
It becomes a coordination problem. I got a lot of mileage out of the very, very first exercise of Gary Chester's book, The New Breed. And the very first exercise, he asks you to play 16ths actually on two hi-hats, but you can do it on one hi-hat.
Yeah.
But both together, both hands together, playing in unison, 16ths, and then read...
I mean, that alone without flamming is already super hard.
And then you read the bass drum lines.
Yeah.
So you play boom, 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 and 20 minutes of that... After 20 minutes of doing that kind of practice, when I go to play a groove, I think, wow, I can actually hear and feel a difference. So I kind of took that approach and expanded on it and tried to find some other exercises that would show you some of the coordination problems between playing notes on the hi-hat and the bass drum and not flam.
So because this it was, sorry.
Because this was something that 99% of all the drummers in all the countries I did it, I must have had, I would say, 600 drummers play this one song and analyzed 600 drummers from about 5 different countries. So actually, it was a very interesting experiment for me, and I enjoyed it.
It's almost like a study. It's like you conducted a study in
timing. I did,
timing.
And it appealed to my, you know, sort of uber analytical mind.
Yeah.
And it was a very interesting study for me because I was learning something where quite often at a drum clinic, as you know, the only fun bit is when someone asks you a question you haven't been asked before.
Yeah.
And it makes you think, that's interesting. Otherwise, you're just kind of, you know, it's a performance thing and... I was getting a bit bored with that, and the masterclass was much more up close and personal, and I was learning about these other drummers. So I developed a few exercises to do with simple coordination about not flamming the bass drum with the hi-hat and finding situations like you might play a paradiddle on the hi-hat.
Yeah.
And then you play boom, 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 boom on the bass drum.
Right.
Which is only one of 10 different bass drum patterns. And wow, suddenly there's a couple of notes in that bass drum line that are really hard to play because of the way it interacts with the paradiddle sticking on your hands. You think, every time I go off a double left off the two lefts and I've got a bass drum that plays on the second left and then onto the next right, I always fall over at that point.
Yeah. And I find it powerful because it doesn't only do like a unison thing and a timing thing, but through that, it kind of makes you bulletproof In terms of, okay, if the left hand plays a note and I want to hit it, it's fine with the bass drum. If I play a left hand note and I want to hit it, kind of, it prepares you for anything that could go in that direction. And yeah. what is also great about what you said is, what you did with your study and like what's the difference between clinics and this really working with people. And I also find this out at my masterclasses is, at things like Drumeo, which is great, or clinics, you can give the people what they want.
Yeah.
But with stuff like that, you can give the people what they need. Because yeah. you can analyze and be like, maybe you haven't thought of that question, but this is what I see. And this is so powerful. So this would be an exercise about unison and timing and stuff. What about like tempo, when someone is rushing, dragging, what would you say there?
Well, I mean, it's just obvious that when you're younger or you're less experienced and you're going to play a fill at the start of a song, it's almost guaranteed that you're going to rush it. Mm. So I would always, you know, if I have to play one, two, one, two, start, do 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 pat, right? Mm. I'm still singing the subdivisions. Anything that would stop me from rushing that right. fill.
And because singing the subdivisions in your head makes them conscious and probably makes you aware of the grid instead of what you're playing, right?
Yeah, and I've got to say that a very big influence on me was the very first Steve Gadd video.
Yeah.
Was it called Up Close? Yeah, it's called Up Close.
Yeah, Up Close, and then the other one was In Session.
In Session, yeah. Up Close. I'd never seen... I mean, I'd seen Steve Gadd play in 1981. I saw him play live in London. But when I saw his video, and I watched it a billion times...
Oh, yeah, me too.
I couldn't believe how relaxed he was. Mm. The way he counted in, the posture... And the way that he didn't rush the fills, that had a very big influence on me.
Yeah.
And when I was in studios or when I was on stage with artists and we were playing very big stadium gigs, it was in the back of my mind the way that Steve Gadd approached the time with his relaxed posture and his relaxed attitude. You know, that was a very powerful influence on me when I kind of got into the position of high pressure.
Nice.
And being in situations of high pressure situations like sessions or playing in the 90s, playing in stadiums with an Italian artist in front of 90,000 people on a live TV show. I thought, this is classic. This is exactly where I'm going to rush like mad.
Yeah.
And that Steve Gadd video influenced me a lot. Just in the way that he, his whole body language was and how relaxed he was. I've never seen anyone so relaxed at the drum kit.
Awesome. Hey, what is the biggest time wasters when practicing? What is the dangerous stuff where you say like, this I should have, or like people shouldn't do that. That's stupid.
Just hours and hours and hours of diddling around on a practice pad, pointlessly. You know, playing just a load of nonsense. And I did a lot of that. I used to put a practice pad on my bed and then I would get two pillows and pretend they were, you know, four toms and a floor, and I would just rattle around. But, you know, I was probably learning something, but I didn't feel like I'd learned anything.
Right.
All I was really doing was just exercising my muscles and just kind of, I didn't know what I was doing. In 1980, I did a gig in Switzerland, and I was playing in a cafe bar in the town square of Lugano, beautiful place. And at night, when the other two band members were asleep, I would go and sit next to a fountain with a practice pad because the fountain made so much noise. The water, I could sit. It was the summer, and I would sit 2 or 3 hours next to the fountain. And just play exercises on a practice pad and no one could hear me. But it was aimless. I would play paradiddles. I would play double stroke rolls. It wasn't going anywhere. It was just, I kind of felt guilty that I wasn't practicing.
Right.
And I couldn't practice because my drums were set up at the cafe bar in the square. And I just wanted to do something.
Can you kind of like specify like what is the difference then between that and you sitting at the drums, listening, recording and blah, blah, blah? What is the difference? Why is this when you say like, oh, just a bunch of nonsense? So what makes nonsense nonsense and non-nonsense non-nonsense for you?
Well, an unconscious mind, really. When I'm practicing the drums, and I'm in my studio and I might record them. It's about listening, considering, and judging and hopefully improving. When I was just sitting with a practice pad going, it just, you know, I wasn't really listening, to be honest. And it wasn't structured in any way. I wasn't trying to improve my sense of playing in time or improve my ability to play a paradiddle. I don't know what I was doing. I was just messing around.
So it's not so much about the hands, is it?
No, none of it's about the hands.
Yeah.
And some of my favorite drummers, actually, it turns out, have got pretty poor technique. having great ideas is the most impressive thing to me. When someone plays a great idea on the drums, even if they don't perform it particularly well, I just think, that's the real magic. They came up, they invented something that was just like, that's brilliant. You know, and I'm talking about like Stuart Copeland is a good example.
Right.
It's like, where did you get that idea from? That is brilliant. That's real magic. If you think he didn't play it as well as Steve Gadd, well, that's okay. You know, as Einstein said, you know, imagination is more important than knowledge. Mm. And coming up with great ideas is great, because once you've got a great idea, you can refine the technique and the performance to perfection later.
Yeah.
But if you only come at it from a technique point of view, I started to find I didn't have good ideas. I just had lots of notes and lots of kind of technical things, but without a good idea. I think if you start with a good idea, you can fill in the details. If you start with the details, they don't add up to a good idea.
But I think you have that mindset where you also want to cultivate that. You when you work on your stuff or you record for other people, this is really on your mind to be like, you think melodically, then you think, and this is really a constant. It's almost like a quality standard that always like comes with it. And probably if you wouldn't have it, it then wouldn't show up. So it's also, I think what I'm basically wanting to say is like, I can hear that in your playing, definitely, that you have that quality standard. But do you also practice that? I mean, you definitely prioritize that. Is that already enough to be like, I want it to be different. I want this to be, because this will shape your decisions, right?
Yeah. And I want to sound original. I gave up trying to play like Steve Gadd when I was doing in the early 80s when Steve Gadd was very, very popular and the Yamaha, black Yamaha kit came out. Lots of people bought it. I was one of them. And I remember I was playing in a club in London and it was in a basement and I could see some people coming in down the stairs and a drummer came down the stairs who I actually recognized, another professional drummer. And he said, oh Christ, not another Steve Gadd clone. And it was the first time I realized that that's what I had become.
All right.
And I was thinking, well, what shall I play on this song? Well, what would Steve Gadd play on this song?
Right.
Right. And I gave up trying to be like him. And I stopped trying to copy other drummers. And I thought, when I invent drum parts or drum grooves or whatever I'm going to do, I must try to remember to not sound really like someone else. There might be influences of Steve Gadd or Vinnie Colaiuta or Simon Phillips or any other drummer that I was listening to at the time, but it's got to sound like me. And it's easy because I'm the only person in the world who is me.
Right.
So I'm really the best person in the world to do an impression of myself, because no one can do a better impersonation of me than I can.
Right.
So it's when you look at it, it really makes sense to be your own drummer and to come up with your own ideas. When you're heavily into a certain drummer, it's really hard to get out of that mindset that everything you play, you think, I want it. What would Stuart Copeland do? Oh, yeah, he'd do this. And then you start to play too much like someone else.
Yeah.
And you develop your own systems. I think the You find creative solutions to your practice problems. You find creative solutions to the way that you have to approach a job, and they are personal to you. And in the end, it starts to sound more like you. I mean, yeah. Lots of people say to me, oh, I can tell it's you. In the first two bars, I can tell it's you. Yeah. I can't really hear that because I am me.
Right.
It's more obvious to you than it is to me. When I hear you play, I think, oh, that's Benny Greb. Mm. And the things that might make me think it's Benny Greb are maybe not the same things that you think it's Benny Greb, right? I might hear something you do and I think, oh, that sounds like Benny. And it's not obvious to you because you are you. It's a surreal idea, but I'm not trying to sound like me. I'm just trying not to sound too much.
Maybe by not trying to sound like anyone else, like you come through automatically also.
Yeah.
Because you have your quality standard and you have your things that your agenda, and then that is just an expression of your personality that of course no one else has. But here's something that I find interesting about this, where I once heard this sentence of, if you want to become rich, don't do what rich people do now, do what they did like in the beginning. Because if you now buy a yacht, like, it's not a great idea to become rich. You'll be broke right away. So you have to do what they did in the beginning, like not spending much money and working hard, blah, 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 if you believe that capitalistic stuff. But the principle is interesting, because would you believe that this being yourself kind of thing, focusing on yourself, is that something that comes later when you listened a lot to Steve Gadd and you da, 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 and so you have to do that? Or do you think it is basically possible that someone who focuses on the right things, focus on the tempo, focus on the time sound, and doesn't listen to other drummers really, like can immediately find his own thing? Or do you think it's good to have this research phase and then?
Yeah, I can't imagine having not been influenced by certain drummers.
Yeah.
And I can hear it now. I'll play some things and I'll think, that really is a bit of Jeff Porcaro coming through. I can hear that. And it's deliberate. I can't help it. But it's something that I loved. But I hope it's not so obvious that people think, oh, that was just a copy. I try to be original as much as I can. Sometimes if you're playing in a pop band or you're playing in a very typical rock band, there aren't so many things you can do. I mean, I try to develop my own sound, and some of that is technique. Some of it is the way that you hit the drums, the way you strike the drums. Yeah. A little bit of it, I think, is the equipment choice and the equipment choices that you make and the tuning and the heads, etc. But the very big part of it is you. And that was very obvious in that recording masterclass thing I did.
Yeah.
Was listening to 12 drummers all play my drum set.
Yeah.
Sometimes even using my drumsticks.
Yeah.
And we left all the desk set up exactly the same.
Yeah.
Wow. It really sounded like 12 different drum sets.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And it was a very, from an engineering point of view, it was actually, and it proved to everyone in the room, including the engineer and the other 12 drummers, how much you make the difference in the sound.
Yeah.
And what the thing I noticed was, I don't think there was one person who even played half of the volume that I did.
Yeah.
at the end of the little session, I used to say, okay, just for reference, let's go back to the beginning and hear me play this song.
Yeah, and it just exploded.
Yeah, you can even see it on the wave shapes.
Definitely.
I would say, look at the snare drum. Look, I'm right up here, and almost every snare drum accent is coming up to the same mark. Now Let's listen, look at someone else's drum. You know, the snare drum's going up and down in volume, and really you're tickling it. Yeah. You're not getting a certain sound. I don't play loud because I want to be the loudest guy in the band. I play loud for the tone that I want from the drums. I hit them relatively, it turns out, quite hard. I didn't know I was a loud drummer until I started comparing myself to other drummers in a recording session that was like the perfect test, or the time that I went to do the Fantasy Drum Camp, which I know you've done too.
Yeah.
And on one of the jam nights, I was looking at Steve Smith, Chris Coleman, Dave Weckl, Peter Erskine. Their sticks all look so tiny to me.
They're toothpicks.
Yeah, they're toothpicks. And I thought, wow, where did I get that from? It must be there's something in me, you know, I didn't grow up as a rock drummer, but there's something in me that I want to hit the drums at a certain intensity for the sound point of view. Because, yeah. You know, as you know, in a recording, you can turn them up and down as loud as you want or as quiet as you want.
Yeah.
But it was more about consistency of tone that I realized I hit the drums louder than 99% of the students that I did the test on.
Yeah.
I did a lot of it in Italy, and it was interesting because then I went to Germany and I did one. I did one in China. I did two in the UK, and I think I did one in the States. And I was kind of secretly interested to know, is there a difference between a German drummer or an Italian drummer or a Chinese drummer or any other type of drummer? And actually, they were all the same. The results were all the same. All the stereotypical things went out the window.
Beautiful. Wow. I got to say, I could talk to you, and we sometimes do, for hours. This has been amazing. I learned a lot, quite egoistically. I learned a lot. Thank you so much.
And pleasure.
I'm sure that everyone out there will love it. So thank you so much for your time. Is there anything in the end that you will say, anything that we didn't discuss that you find important about practicing? Anything that comes to mind?
Not really, except I think once you practice a lot, you start to find your own method of practice, your own schedule. If you're the kind of guy who wants to play single stroke roles for an hour, then there's nothing wrong with that. You're that guy. If you can sit in a room for 8 hours and play double bass drum, that's fine as well. But I think eventually, just through the thousands of hours you end up doing, you find your own path. And where I am at the moment, for me, it just works out to for one reason or another, to do lots of short bursts of, say, between 15 and 30 minutes. Whether it's whatever I'm trying to practice, that's about the most I can do very focused. I can play the drums for 4 hours, of course, but I don't think my mind is engaged for 4 hours. To really engage my mind and my concentration, I think 15 to 30 minutes, that window is about right. And then I stop for an hour, I do other things, you know, and then I come back to it. I might start something else, or I might go back to what I was practicing an hour ago and try it again. And just that's the method that I have found works for me at the moment. I don't know in the future if that will be the same, but it seems to have been like that for the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, but that's the beautiful thing. When you say, like, okay, my mind is not engaged, like for some drummers or musicians in general, it might be okay. They're like, oh, but I'm working my muscles, the blood gets flowing and stuff. But your quality standard is like, no, my mind has to be engaged. For you, this sound thing is so important. This musicality thing is so important. And this really informs the way you're practicing. And for you, it's just not good enough anymore, it seems, when, oh, I'm dreaming away. I don't have this analytical UK dragon available anymore. So that's no practicing for me anymore. I don't want to waste time just moving my hands and yeah, kind of my body doing something. I use my head and my aesthetics and my heart. So that's amazing. And I think that sums it up beautifully, like how your whole practicing seems to be at a service to that higher goal of like producing something sound-wise and creatively that's of value to you. So that explains basically all your intense scientific kind of with gear and with how you analyze stuff and how you go about things. So
yeah.
Amazing. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure, Benny.
All right, I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. Hey, let me just quickly say there is no sponsoring on this podcast. The sponsor is me. So if you want to support this and are interested in this subject, go to bennygrab.com. There is a wonderful book that a very charming German guy has written, which is called Effective Practicing for Musicians. Basically, it teaches you how to become better at becoming better in terms of practicing for musicians. The title says it all. if you haven't checked it out so far, check it out. And whatever you do, I wish you all the best. Next episode will be just me reflecting about something, and I hope you will listen to this one as well. Till then, all the best. Bye-bye.